Psalm 22. All right, we're looking at, and we'll be looking for the next several weeks in all three studies on Sunday at Psalms 22, 23, 24, because they are a trilogy, and we'll develop that a little bit more a little bit later. However, when we look at Psalm 22, this is what is often called the Psalm of the Cross, and the reason for that is because it describes exactly what Christ was thinking on the cross. Also, the fact that it begins and ends in verse 1 and in verse 31, beginning, first of all, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And then finally in verse 31, the last words on the cross, which are translated in King James, is that he hath done, or we could translate that it is finished. So from my God, why hast thou forsaken me, clear through to it is finished. The other remarkable thing about Psalm 22, and we'll summarize it now but see some details later, is that in talking about the death of Christ, it not only talks about his death, but it talks about and describes death by crucifixion. And the remarkable thing about that is the fact that it contains some details that would only pertain to a death by crucifixion, and also the fact that the nation under whom he would die, who used crucifixion as their capital offense punishment, wasn't even born yet. The Jews would execute capital punishment, of course, by Old Testament prescription, by stoning. And Rome, of course, when we're looking at Psalm 22, Rome didn't even exist. And therefore, looking clear down to the time that an empire would rise and that empire would have as their means of execution, crucifixion, to note some of the features that are involved in that. In the first place, can you imagine in a crucifixion, how that would be executed, and very often we see a picture with Christ hanging on the cross. How would he get in that position? Well, the method would not be to erect a cross and then try to get a person nailed onto the cross. The method would be to lay the cross down on the ground, lay the person like they were on a couch onto the cross, and then nail the hands, cross the feet, and nail them on at the bottom of the cross. Then you would raise the cross and drop it into a already dug hole. Now, you can imagine what that would do if you had your entire body weight, for example, as you would, on your hands, and especially if with the nails. Consequently, you would have, obviously, your possibility of bones, especially your shoulder, strong possibility of bone dislocation. And if you notice in Psalm 22, verse 14, one of the statements of the verse is, I am poured out like water, all my bones are out of joint. And I'm sure that a reader that was not thinking of crucifixion would wonder, well, the man is dying, what form of death is he dying? Well, the bone dislocation is in perfect harmony with the idea of crucifixion. A second would be what you have in verse 15, obviously dehydration under that kind of suffering would take place very easily. And one of the features that you have in the 15th verse is, my strength is dried up like a potsherd, the exhaustion brought about by the agony, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, which would be the dehydration. Of course, his cry on the cross was, I thirst, and that would fit with that. The other feature that fits in with crucifixion would be in verse 16. Dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced hands and feet. And so the pierced hands, feet feature, which would attach Christ to the cross, is prophesied. This is why, incidentally, and it's sometime noted that in Roman execution, they didn't always nail a person on a cross. Sometimes they would simply take a rope and tie the wrists onto the to the cross. Or, at times, they would use the nails. It's very clear, both the New Testament account and here, that the hands and feet were nailed on the cross. Now, you can imagine the agony that would be involved in this type of thing. And, therefore, you would have, in this type of thing, obviously, a mental, and I don't really want to use the word mental collapse, because I think the word collapse is too strong for it. But I think you do have very clear evidence that there was a mind deterioration. Not that Christ at any point did not have control, but there was a tremendous mental pressure, and that is certainly implied in verse 14. I'm poured out like water, all my bones are out of joint, my heart. And this, again, I take it would not be a reference to the heart organ, but the heart used as it is often in Scripture for the mind, the emotions, and so forth, is, and here's the analogy, like wax. Well, anything that is like melted wax, the essence of it is it's formless. It's not held together. And I take it that under the agony of the cross, part of it was in the mind. And the figure of speech is that the normal rationality that the mind, or the form that the mind would be able to think with, is lost. And much like under a pressure, you say, well, due to the pressure or the agony of the situation, we can't think, and the normal forms of logic begin to deteriorate, they begin to melt. And this happened on the part of Christ, and that indicates no weakness in his being, it's simply part of his suffering. And I think we'll try to establish part of this today, that one of the very serious mistakes that we make is that we're so often emphasizing the deity of Christ, and that is correct. He's deity in every sense of the word, but we forget that he felt just like we feel. And if you have felt weariness, we can be assured that Jesus Christ felt weariness. And if you know what it is to be under a pressure where you feel like your mind just isn't going to be able to handle it, we can be assured that this also happened to Jesus Christ. All of this without sin. But nonetheless, all of the physical pressures, as we had beginning in chapter 22, verse 1, the words, my God, why hast thou forsaken, they weren't spoken. Not at all. They were screamed. And if we have a hard time because we've been thinking of Christ as sovereign, he's in control, which he is, but if we've taken that to the point that we can't identify with the fact that he hurt so bad in his humanity that he screamed like a person in tremendous pain, then we have missed a very important and fundamental part of his character. Now, one other thing is added to his death by crucifixion that is often overlooked, but I think it's clearly implied when we get down to verse 18, when it says, they cast or part my garments among them and cast lots upon my vesture, is that the Hebrew text, and we'll look at the word for garment and the word for vesture, basically the word that's involved is often used for undergarment. And so it's not simply the idea that they took the cloak off Christ, but as he was placed on the cross to further the humility, the humiliation of it, you had the nudity aspect. And I think we will be able to support when we get down to verse 18, which we will next Sunday, be able to support that they stripped Christ of his clothing. And sometimes in pictures of Christ on the cross, you get the partial lack of clothing, and then you have a cloth or something wrapped about Christ. And I'm sure for a drawing that's appropriate. But as far as the actual suffering of Christ on a cross, a part of the humiliation that he went through was to be stripped of clothing and placed on a cross, and you can see the mingling of blood, the nudity, and the humiliation that would be involved on the cross, keeping in mind at all of the time that with a thought he could have terminated that. And this, of course, is expounding really what Romans 5 is indicating, that Christ died for us when we were enemies, and therefore all of this is pointing in that particular direction. Not only is the death by crucifixion get a literal fulfillment in these things, but there are also additional elements. For example, the cry of verse 1. That's literal. Also, when you have in verse 2, he cries in the daytime, and the Lord doesn't hear. He cries in the night, and he is not silent. Is that the day-night alteration takes place on the cross? Because remember, it was from the sixth to the ninth hour, which is only half of the crucifixion, that it was dark. And therefore, when he says in verse 2 that he cries in the day and is not heard, he cries in the night and is not heard, we need to be reminded that half of the cross was visible by daylight. half of the cross was enshrouded by God the Father in darkness. And therefore, even in verse 2, everything said there can apply directly to the time on the cross, because there was a daytime on the cross and there was a nighttime on the cross. The nighttime, of course, is the heart of the cross suffering, and that, of course, is where we come in with Psalm 22. The remark about the garments, the casting lots on those, gets a literal fulfillment, Matthew 27:35. And then finally, notice the declaration in verse 22. Verse 22 is the break point over from death on the cross to the resurrection. And with the resurrection, or with the termination of the death phase, he says to God the Father, I will declare your name to my brethren. So the promise is, upon the end of the death, it will be God's name that will be proclaimed to my, or Jesus' brethren. And that is a literal fulfillment also. Look at John chapter 20. Because the first thing done upon the resurrection by Christ was to fulfill the prophecy of Psalm 22. And here we've got the first action on the part of Christ. He meets and reveals himself to Mary. And verse 17, Jesus says to her, Mary, touch me not. That is not at all adequate as far as translation is concerned. The scene is dramatic. Mary suddenly recognizes the Lord, and she grabs him. And the expression is, don't touch me, like don't start to. It's stop it. It's forbidding a practice that's going on. Stop clinging to me. In other words, Mary, upon the revelation that's the Lord, apparently dives for him and grabs him. And he says, stop grabbing me, stop clutching me, for I am not ascended to my Father, but, and here's a thing that needs to be done, go to my brethren and say to them, I ascend to my Father and your Father, my God and your God. And notice you have a fulfillment of exactly what Psalm 22 said. He promised to do upon the resurrection is, Father, I will proclaim to my brethren your name. And he does just exactly that, primarily in the sense that the name is proclaimed to the brethren as, this is your Father. Now, before we do some more detail with Psalm 22, let's do a little more to establish in our own minds a good beginning base for the fact that Christ was really human. When we talk about the nature of Jesus Christ, you do have in the New Testament a word description. And the word description for Christ is found in a verse we don't even need to turn to, John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And the word only begotten is one word, monogenes. And I don't know that any of our translations have ever really given that or not. The word means unique. Now, even when we use the word unique to modify his Son, which is indicating that the author is saying, there is something that he perceives in Jesus that's different, that is unique from others. Now, even when we use this word unique, we need to sharpen that up a little bit, simply because in the English language, we often use or misuse the word unique. And we misuse it by saying with it a word such as most unique. And to say most unique is like saying this is a round circle. You don't need the word round. A circle is a circle. And unique is unique. Unique simply means there is nothing like it. and therefore you couldn't have a thing that's unique, but this is more unique. This is different than everything else, but this is more different than anything else. So unique simply means nothing like it. In other words, there is no place that you compare anything to this. When, therefore, John says, God gave his only begotten Son, he is saying the Son or the nature of Jesus is unlike anything or anyone else. Now, with that, then, we can make some statements that are easily supported by the material we've got in the New Testament about Christ. And that is, Jesus is perfect humanity. That means he is humanity. He is just like us, except no sin. Now, that's hard to identify with, because how can you think of anything that we've never... I mean, where are you going to find among us this morning? We can find lots of humanity. We can't find any perfect humanity. We can't find any humanity that's without sin. And consequently, it stretches the mind to think about it, but nonetheless, he is humanity. And the important thing to keep in mind, then, is that the feelings, the emotions, the physical functions, all the physical functions that were his, that are ours, are also his, except we've got to remove sin from that. He is perfect humanity and deity. And all of that is in one person. Unique? The only thing we can identify with is sinful humanity. That is easy to identify with, but even when we try to think of his humanity and then remove sin from it, it becomes difficult. Now we've got to put in that he is that, and at the same time, he is also deity in the full sense of the word. Now, there is an expression that brings that across. Look at Hebrews 1:3. Without the understanding of his humanity, we do not understand what's going on in Psalm 22. Hebrews 1:3. Speaking of Christ, he's referred to the Son in verse 2, and in verse 3 it says, who, that is the Son, being the brightness of his glory and the express image of his person. And if you're looking at a Greek testament, the word for person would be hypostasis. And expressing hypostasis simply means a person's essence. What makes them what they are. Essence, or its substantial nature, was used that way. Person's not a bad translation. But I went to the word in order to point out that in expressing who the person of Christ is, this word, hypostasis, meaning his essence, his nature, what makes him what he is, this word hypostasis has been used throughout church history and transliterated in order to talk about the, and here's the way it gets translated, the hypostatic union. Hypostatic union means his humanity and his deity are united in one person. Now, when we talk about the hypostatic union of Christ, we can say several things. Number one, this means he is not a human person indwelled by deity. That is not Jesus Christ. In other words, he is not a human being on whom God came. Does not reflect the teaching of the New Testament, and that is not the hypostatic union. Second, this union changes neither. So that when Christ took a human body, what did it do to his deity? Nothing. It didn't change his deity at all. And if Christ is deity, how did that change his humanity? No way. So that the fact that he is human doesn't change his deity. The fact that he's deity doesn't change his humanity. So that if that's true, when he was a baby in a crib, which is obvious humanity, how did that affect his deity that was holding the whole universe together? It didn't. The baby in the crib held the universe together because the weakness of that humanity and the fact that in his humanity as a baby he couldn't talk yet and could only perhaps make the movements that a little baby would make, the three-week-old baby who is obvious humanity and appears to be the essence of inability to talk, to feed himself, and do all of those things is at the same time holding the entire universe together. Unique? Anyone around like that? This is the person we're talking about. We'll develop that a little bit more later. A third feature that is important is the fact that his deity in his earthly life is self-limited. By that I mean he doesn't choose to exercise what he and his deity can do all the time. And a good example of that would be Matthew 27, when on the cross, what did he say? As he is himself becoming the victim of their mistreatment, he says, "Don't make a mistake. I could call 12 legions of angels at this moment for delivery." Did he do it? No. Could he have done it? Yes. Why? Deity could have done it. But his deity was self-limited in his earthly life. Now, whenever we deal with passages, and this is an important thing always to remember, whenever we deal with passages that talk about Jesus Christ, we've got three classes. Class one is that kind of passage that are true only of the deity of Christ. Second, passages that make statements of those true only of his humanity. Keep this in mind and eliminate a lot of confusion. And then third, passages that are true of both. Let's give one sample for each. John 8:58. Each of these passages will talk about Jesus Christ and will view him in his hypostatic union and will either emphasize something that's true of both his deity and his humanity, or one or the other. Chapter 8, verse 58. Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say unto you, before Abraham was, I am." Now try to apply that, first of all, to his humanity. You got problems, don't you? Because the humanity of Christ was started with the incarnation. You don't get the humanity of Christ until Bethlehem, and even if we're really weak in history, Bethlehem is a few months after Abraham. And he's saying at this point that I existed before Abraham. That's impossible in his humanity. It is, therefore, a verse that is true what? The verse is talking only of the deity aspect of Christ. Just back a page, for an easy example, in John 4:6. Says Jacob's well was there. Now Jesus, therefore, being wearied. Now apply that to deity. God is exhausted. God is tired. And you have immediate problems with the fact that God is omnipotent. He has all the power in the world, and God doesn't tire. Well, how are you going to fit this verse in? He's not talking about the deity of Christ. He's talking about the humanity of Christ, John 4, verse 6. Or you could have those that, especially those that relate to his sinlessness, that would relate both to his deity and to his humanity. And recognizing these things is very important because they become sometimes, if we don't see this hypostatic union, the subject of many a silly discussion in Sunday school about, well, I thought that we had established that Jesus knew everything. And here in this passage, he's talking about his second coming, and it says he doesn't know the day nor the hour. So we have a big problem here. We do have a big problem. The big problem is the ignorance of the reader as to who we're reading about. And there's no problem there. The point is, Jesus is deity and humanity, and a passage may view either one of them. As to his humanity, he grew and developed. Now, where do we stand, then, in grasping the most about him? Do we understand most about his deity, or do we understand and appreciate most about his humanity? And if we are weak on number two, and evangelical Christianity has to be weak on number two, because there have been many a year of doing battle of those that say Jesus is not deity, and we come on with all the guns that indicate he is deity in every sense of the word, and become so fixated on the deity that we forget, and I'll use the words that a professor in seminary used once. He says we sometimes are so obsessed with the deity of Christ that we forget that Jesus also went to the restroom. And the emphasis there is that he is deity, but do we also picture Jesus as a real man in every sense of the word? Or do we have him, I think in most mentalities, going about Palestine with a halo aglow, swathed in robes, so that you really didn't know whether he had calf muscle or whether he had biceps or not, or whether all those, did he have teeth, ears, nose, eyebrows, hair on his head, fingernails? You think Christ ever had a hangnail? I'm not trying to be trivial. I'm trying to bring us into focus on the fact that he who is deity in every sense of the word is also humanity in every sense of the word without sin. The New Testament book, incidentally, that builds around this is the book of Hebrews, where that you have such remarks as Christ calls us brothers. And that's from the standpoint of his humanity. You look at the deity aspect, and it sounds rather strange. You mean deity? God is saying, hey, brother, to me? Well, from the standpoint of the humanity of Christ, that's a perfectly appropriate type thing and something. This, by the way, is where we appreciate him as our high priest. Because this is where Hebrews comes off with the fact he feels what we feel, the agony and the suffering of being part of the human race. He knows what that's like in every sense of the word. And this is also true in what's being brought out in Psalm 22, and let's go back to it. Psalm 22. And I put that as preface. I'll try to demonstrate part of this today, but one of the striking things that I found in Psalm 22 is a strong conviction that the prophet Isaiah had a favorite book that he liked to read. And I'm pretty thoroughly convinced that Isaiah's favorite book that he liked to read was the book of Psalms. We'll find in verse 6 some word-for-word identical expressions that Isaiah uses, and many, many times I'm thoroughly convinced that Isaiah got much that he got about Christ not only by revelation as a prophet, but by reading in the book of Psalms, because there is point after point where there are direct parallels between the two. That also, by the way, says something about Psalms. If you're going to think of an Old Testament prophet that pointed out what the Messiah was going to be like, who are you going to think of? I think in most minds we're going to go to Isaiah. It's the fattest book, 66 chapters. He says the most. He's got probably the most messianic prophecy in it as any prophet in the Old Testament. And he's unquestionably a very major, major prophet. Well, if the major prophet of the Old Testament got much of his material about the coming Christ from where? From reading the book of Psalms. And what does that say to us about Psalms? It says that Psalms is one of your key doctrinal books of the Old Testament. Psalms is not a soft, smooth, devotional, as we've said, a psalm a day keeps something away, whatever. it's very heavy as far as doctrine is concerned. All right, we're looking at what we are going to call the Psalms of Salvation. That's not what the Psalms call themselves, but that's what we're going to call them because of their content, which are 22 through 24. And the reason for calling them that is they picture the full scope of salvation. As we well know, our salvation is rooted in the cross, and we proceed through the cross until ultimately Christ returns. That's a crown. And we have Christ reigning, and this is exactly the sequence. Psalm 22, Christ on the cross. Psalm 24, you've got the King of Glory has come in. And then in between that, you've got Psalm 23. So we move from the cross of Christ to the care, shepherd care of Christ, to the reign of Christ. And that's why they're called a trilogy. In the trilogy, they move logically from First Advent, Second Advent, Inter-Advent. We ought to put inter and pre-Advent, because this is not to say that he wasn't the shepherd before the First Advent, because right here Christ hadn't come the first time and he's still the shepherd, but this is his care inter and pre-First Advent on the part of Christ. So that we're ready now, having looked at last week at the five parts, and if you were not here, Psalm 22 does have five parts to it very quickly. Verses 1 and 2, address to God. That's obvious. Verse 1, my God, my God. Verse 2, oh my God. Verse 3, trust sections, remember, come in with the word, but thou. Simply think of many times in the Psalm, David doing a 180-degree turn. And over here is the problem. And he's looking at the problem, and he's deep into the problem, and he says, Lord, I'm about to die, and the enemy is about to kill me. And then with the word, but thou, he'll pivot. And as he pivots, he'll completely turn away from the problem, and he'll say, but forget it all, because I'm reminded of who God is as to his character. And you have the agony of verses 1 and 2 where he addresses God. Then he turns, and what's he turned to? Very typical. David will turn from the agony of pressure to the character of God. That is very practical. David will, the kind of honesty before God, he'll look over here and say, look at the enemy. The enemy is wrong, and nothing's happening to the enemy. The enemy is prospering, and I'm not prospering. Evil is growing and growing, and he laments and laments and looks at the horrible situation, and then just as though his mind light turns on, he says, but you're righteous, you're just, and you can almost feel the boiling agony of the problem. The heat's off, and it simmers down, and he begins to look at the character of God. And as Christ on the cross is saying, why have you forsaken me? And the agony boils with perfect trust, and yet his father has turned his back on him, and then he turns to a reminder. But, in spite of all that appears, and all that looks on the surface, I look to the character of God. And the interesting thing about that is that David is not at all afraid to be very realistic and say to the Lord in prayer, I'm not getting a fair deal. You're not acting toward the righteous the way you ought to. You're letting sin continue. They're getting the prosperity, and you can complain and complain and complain and complain. But the last analysis is, that's what I'm seeing. But I know something. You're holy. And we ought to be able to identify with that, because unless I'm in a ballpark all alone, I can look at a situation and say, that is not right, that is not right, that is not right, and God is not doing anything, and to every appearance, he's not even home. But he is. And that's part of the not putting your head in the sand over the agony and the pressure that we see, But at the same time, we come back and say, well, that's what I see. But what is the character of God. And that, in essence, is 2 Corinthians 5:7. We walk how? By faith, not by what we see. Really, if we look at what we see, we'll always misinterpret the character of God. Because justice indicates that sin is going to be punished and taken care of. And open your eyes and look around. Is that the way it works? No, not at all. But that's what we see. And the character of God says something quite different. So with that, but thou, in verse 3, he goes to the character of God. And then in verse 6, you come to the what we've been calling the stress or the lament section. And that's quite long, 6 through 18. And essentially, this is what Christ thinks while he's on the cross. And as we said about this particular 6 through 18, this is the only light that we get on what happened when God turned the lights out on the cross. Because this coincides with the darkness period of the cross, the darkness half, so that God, as he was crucified, turns out the light switch, enshrouds the whole scene in darkness, and we see nothing. So that, at that point of time, when God turned out the lights, that's when Christ begins to quote Psalm 22. And so, this is the only light we've got as to what was going on while Christ was on the cross. Then in 19 through 21, notice you get, in each verse, you get a petition. 19, don't be far from me. 20, deliver my soul. 21, save me from the lion's mouth. And notice we have a lot of images here taken from the animal kingdom. And I think some of these, for example, if you go back to verse 12, he says, many bulls have surrounded me. And you say, well, is this just strictly poetic expression here? I don't think it has to be. In the first place, when we think of the word bull, we can be assured we've all got the wrong concept. The Hebrew word is a very, very broad word for any horned animal. In other words, there's no way you can take the Hebrew word and fix it to a specific type thing. It's simply horned animal. And if you can recall back in maybe history books that have got pictures in it, have you ever seen where there would be a crown made of a strip of leather and attached to the leather horns? That type of picture. So it's very, very possible that he's referring to people and poetically alluding to them as, here are these men with the leather band with the horns, or animal horns on them, which could be a literal reference in that particular context. But nonetheless, you have the petition down through verse 21. And then finally, of course, the whole thing shifts to nothing but praise. Verse 22, I will declare thy name to my brethren. In the midst of the congregation will I praise thee. And of course, with verse 21, we are now looking into the resurrection phase of Christ. Now, we'll pick up in our next session with the lament, the stress section, and we'll try today, through this evening, get down through verses, perhaps 13 or 14. Father, we're thankful for your Son. We pray that we might appreciate him who is unique in every sense of the word, and while we appreciate the fact that it was deity and deity alone that could provide our salvation, may we recognize that as we look at Jesus Christ, we're also looking at humanity, and recognize that in this humanity there was tremendous agony and suffering, and through the humanity we might be able to identify with him. While viewing his deity, we might be secure in him, recognizing that all the power of deity is backing what he can do for us, for which we give you thanks in his name. Right.